Well, hey, everybody. Thanks for joining me on this week's episode of I Don't Care with me, Dr. Kevin Stevenson. Always appreciate you spending time with me at least once a week, where I have the opportunity to speak with interesting healthcare guests from all around the globe. So, but today's episode, it's somebody that's old home week. It's somebody that actually we lived in Keller together at the same time. Keller is a suburb just north of Fort Worth, a very rapidly growing area. But we were talking before we went on the air and said we probably saw each other at Kroger. But Patrick McCarr, which number one, welcome to I Don't Care. Number two, Patrick goes the professional route, says, oh, we probably met at an ACHE function. But my guess is probably a Kroger, Patrick.
I think that's probably true, Kevin.
Yeah. Well, hey, thanks for joining me today, Patrick. Look forward to our discussion today. Patrick has got some really unique perspectives in healthcare. Not only is he the clinical practice manager for ENT and head and neck surgery for UT Southwestern in Dallas, but he is also a head and neck cancer survivor. And so somebody, you know, I always find that providers who have actually been patients have a different perspective, a different take, and a great deal more empathy than many in our industry. So Patrick, again, welcome.
Thank you, Kevin. Yep. I like to think that I didn't need to get head and neck cancer myself to be an empathetic, passionate patient care a champion, but it gave me insights that I don't think I would have gained any other way. At the time I got diagnosed, I was actually leading the JPS Cancer Center. So not only am I now in ENT where I got some of my treatment, but even back in 2017 when I was diagnosed, I was managing the Comprehensive Cancer Center at JPS in Fort Worth. We had radiation oncology, chemotherapy, pain management. We had the whole spectrum of cancer-related services. And I had been there about 3 years and, you know, got some symptoms that I was concerned about, went to my PCP, did some imaging, and lo and behold, you know, I was diagnosed with a HPV-related head and neck cancer, which has become much more prevalent among the male age groups of 40s and 50s, whereas, you know, historically head and neck cancers were related to aging and smoking and some of the other lifestyle considerations. So it was surprising to me, but, you know, once I took inventory of everything, I thought, wow, I'm really in good hands.
Yeah. Hey, Patrick, talk a little bit about your symptoms, because you're kind of on the other end of where I was about this time last year. I had no symptoms, but went and did a CT calcium score during heart month, and come to find out my calcium score was through the roof. And about a week and a half later, I was the proud owner of 4 stents and never had any symptoms. All my numbers were great. But you never know. So talk a little bit about, you know, about your journey, you know, kind of the symptoms and then, you know, some of the things that you went through, because I know, again, we talked before we went on the air and it really created some interesting things for you.
You know, somewhat similar to you, I didn't have any symptoms that affected my day-to-day life. What I noticed was I had what felt like an inflamed lymph node along my neck. But, you know, I've had lifelong allergies. And here in North Texas, I mean, depending on which way the wind blows, you know, you're sneezing or you're dried out or, you know, something. So I didn't think much of it. And I can't really tell you how long I felt it. But then not long after, I found one down around my collarbone. And I've had enough anatomy and physiology and you know, I've been around healthcare professionals my whole career. I thought, you know what, I'm going to get this checked out. And so, you know, we've got a great family practice, PCP in South Lake. So I made an appointment. And what really started to get me concerned was as soon as she felt them, she said, yeah, we need to get these checked out. And that was, you know, one of those things, probably like your coronary calcium test score, you know, you think all of a sudden you're like, I didn't think I had a problem, but now I might have one. So, and so went through the imaging, like I said, I was at JPS and the cancer program there was managed wonderfully by our medical director for medical oncology. And then we had, you know, somebody that I think is a world-class radiation oncologist. I think she might still be there. And so I realized once the shock kind of wore off, I thought, you know, and I firmly believe, you know, God puts you in certain positions in your life. And I thought, you know, I don't know why I'm in this spot. You know, our boys were probably, let me think, that was 9 years ago. So they were 15 and 12 at the time. So, you know, one of those kind of earth rattling situations, but it also galvanized me. I said, you know what, I'm going to do everything I can, no matter what I need to do to get through this, because, you know, unless it's God's plan, I'm not leaving this earth early. So,
you know, you're going through something like cancer, or in my instance, coronary artery disease, and it's incredibly stressful. It's incredibly serious, but there's always humorous little things that happen. Anything funny happened to you during your cancer treatment?
Oh yeah. That's always my perspective, Kevin. So we had any number of things. One of the things that the team that I worked with would laugh about is that I explained this to our team. I did not want to get my treatment in our facility because I wanted to separate being a patient versus being the administrator. And I was, you know, very thoughtful, or I tried to be very thoughtful in talking to our teams about it, because I felt like, you know, we had one of the best teams, both in chemotherapy and radiation therapy. So I wanted it to be clear that I wasn't making the choice to seek care elsewhere. But for me personally, I wanted to separate the patient experience. So I went to, of all places, UT Southwestern in Fort Worth, the Moncrief Cancer Center, and I would get my chemotherapy there on Tuesday morning. So it was 7 weeks of one chemotherapy treatment a week, Tuesday mornings. And ironically, I would feel the best out of all the days of the week on the day I got chemo. And I know that's not typical from, you know, patients I've talked to, but I think the combination of the steroids they would give me to kind of dampen the, you know, immune response or the response your body could have to the chemo made me feel better during the day. But come to find out, when I would get back to work, I would be as white as a ghost. And I've got a pretty pale complexion anyway. And so I walk in and they look at me and they're like, okay, how do you feel today? And I thought, I feel like a million bucks. And they're like, okay, you know, maybe you should sit down. And you know, all these people who are taking great care of our patients are now starting to try to take care of me. And it was funny because they said, you know, you were one of our worst patients.
Oh yeah.
And they, you know, that was one of those stories. And they, you know, there were a lot of, I had a lot of struggles when you go through 7 weeks and 35 treatments of radiation oncology or radiation therapy, you know, and it's essentially treating from here down to here. It becomes difficult at a point, you know, your ability to eat and swallow. And I didn't have a feeding tube, but that was one of the things they cautioned me about, that if you lose the ability to swallow. So that was a great motivator. I mean, I was on the high calorie boost, you know, 5 or 6 a day. So I was able to maintain most of my weight. But I met a lot of people in a way that you don't typically meet, even if you are rounding on patients as an administrator. And so, you know, I think the great thing, or one of the positives of the experience, is carrying that realization with me so that when I round on people now in the clinic, I ask a lot of just introductory questions, you know, about our services, about scheduling. But now I can sense when there's maybe something more. Whereas I think previous to my own experience, I might have kind of passed over it or maybe not inquired because I thought maybe that was too personal. And you know, I certainly consider those boundaries. And if I'm, you know, if I see anything that indicates we've gone too far, then I'm not going to go any further. But there are times where I'll inquire about, you know, something related to how their life's going with treatment. And maybe, you know, here at UT Southwestern, we have tremendous support services for cancer patients. So sometimes it's getting them connected. Sometimes it's, you know, maybe discussing something that might have a little bit of a stigma to it, like accessing certain services or something like that. And it's very gratifying to me when I feel like I can, you know, link somebody up with a service that might benefit them that maybe they wouldn't have considered before our conversation.
Yeah, I'm finding more and more in talking with various people that the lived experience in the healthcare environment is so crucial today. I was at an event a couple of weeks ago, and a woman was talking about her medically complex son, and going through that process and made her a very much more intuitive about what she was trying to do in her career, you know. And you also brought up a really good point, Patrick, because you did something. You tried to separate your personal life from your professional life in your treatment. And I know as a hospital administrator, that was always something that you know, you walk that fine line because, you know, you're out there in the community saying, hey, we provide the best care, and yet you're not getting your care there for a wide variety of reasons. But and I used to do the same thing. And as I got older, it's like, you know, I don't care anymore. and you know, living here in Central Texas, you know, we don't have the treatment options available like in a Dallas Fort Worth. And so, and you know, the full confidence that I had in my you know, in my team, you know, I had no problems there. You know, my vanity about anything on my body is gone. And so if they, you know, they're not going to see anything special, they're not going to, you know, so why not? And we're all professionals here. But my funny experience was going into the cath lab, and, you know, they're prepping me, they've got me on Versed, I'm feeling really happy, but I'm wide awake, you know. And so, you know, my director and my cath lab manager and a number of other folks are up in the viewing room, just like I used to do all the time, you know. And they're in there and they're making jokes and they're like, hey, Kevin, can we have a raise? And I was lucid enough to say no. But you know, so we had a lot of fun with that. But you really brought up that topic that I know, you know, my colleagues are all over the map on that. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, and I see pros and cons both ways.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So with your, you know, with your treatment and everything, you know, obviously, you know, 9 years, you know, survivor, congratulations.
Thank you.
Number one. How has that changed you as a healthcare administrator?
I think it's both changed me as an administrator and as a person, because I think in both areas of my life, and of course they, you know, you being a career administrator, you know, the personal and the professional do overlap quite a bit. I think it's given me a depth of appreciation for the life that I have, but also a deeper appreciation for what somebody who's working here today could be managing in their personal life. And it's made me, I think in some ways, I feel like it slowed me down. You know, when I was younger, earlier in my career, it was move, 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 you know, do, you know, finish this project. And those are all still things that motivate me. But now, if the, you know, I make more time to have one-on-ones with each individual, Because I feel like that's really where you can get into a more in-depth conversation. We have a number of people here that are pursuing, different educational options. Some are going back to school to become a nurse, or, getting a business degree or something. So we can talk about that. But then there's also, my two sons are now 24 and 21. So we don't, have them at home. But I remember having a young family and, who was going to pick them up after school and who's going to do those things. And I think, having that perspective, as well as, people that are here managing their parents as they get older and, maybe needing some flexibility in their work schedule. And I think I've going through my own treatment really kind of galvanized within me the commitment that I had to keeping the best possible team we could have at work that support our providers and our patients, and being flexible in ways that maybe are unique to the individual to keep that team together. As opposed to saying, hey, we can't flex your schedule on Tuesday and Thursday to 7:45 a.m. We've got to keep it at 8 a.m. And then, they can't get out in time to, get their mother or father-in-law to treatment in the afternoon, something like that.
Sure.
I just think, I feel like it's given my life a greater depth, which also affects the way I lead, the clinic, the teams I'm on, and the input that I can provide from a, I sit on the patient advisory council here at UT Southwestern, not as an administrator, but as a cancer survivor. And so to be able to give some input on, what I experienced from a scheduling perspective, now that I know the inside and out of, our scheduling processes, it's a neat combination. I mean, I told somebody not long ago that probably the time since I recovered from my treatment has been my favorite time of my life. So yeah, there's a lot of things that I realized going through that I probably would have taken more for granted if I hadn't.
Well, and I really appreciate what you said about being flexible with your staff. Healthcare obviously is a business, but it's a business all about people. And it's not just all about the patients. It's about our team members as well. And there's a lot of research out there that says, your first customer is your own staff, because if your staff is happy and fulfilled and engaged, that is going to trickle into your medical staff, but definitely to your patients. And I know whenever I've been in facilities that, you can tell that there's some stressors in there in that facility around different things. It's very evident to the patient. And so the more that we can do to help alleviate that professionally, but also personally, is key. Let's transition a little bit, Patrick, into your work as a clinic practice administrator now in ENT and head and neck surgery, but you've got a lot of experience in other areas, pediatrics, radiology, primary care. Let's talk about the stressors on a clinic administrator in today's healthcare environment.
Yeah. From my perspective, in the time I've been here and the time I was at JPS, some of the biggest stressors that we have is trying to be as efficient in our scheduling and our referral processing so that we're maximizing access to care. Because none of these clinics, and it doesn't matter, like you said, I've been in a range from primary care to, super specialties. Access to care is a challenge no matter where you're at. And, we've got a world-renowned head and neck, cancer surgery program here. So you have a certain urgency there that you might not have in a different specialty. So, and that's where I think it plays to my interests and my strengths. My undergraduate degree was in industrial and operations engineering, and that was all about system processes, you know, was kind of that Lean Six Sigma education before it became more popular, you know, throughout healthcare. So that's always been my mindset. And so, but in order to be more efficient on the access to care, you got to have a full complement of team members. And so one of the challenges now is, you know, if we have a vacancy, I feel like, I don't know the numbers offhand, but our vacancies tend to be open longer than they were a few years ago. And, you know, we talk about people that left the workforce after, you know, COVID and the aging workforce population. And I think all those things, you know, contribute to it. And the economists that are much smarter than I am talk about it all the time. But, you know, we feel it here because if we've got five surgery schedulers and one decides to leave for some reason, we're down to 80% of our capacity. And, you know, that's, we don't want to slow down getting patients to surgery for both business reasons and quality of life reasons, because there's urgency there. I think so, to get to a point that you made earlier about, you know, the connection with your team members. One of the things that I tell the supervisors here is the most important recruiting we do is with the people that are here Monday through Friday. You know, if we're not recruiting on a regular basis through quality interaction, setting goals, helping them attain goals, supporting them in their personal life as much as is appropriate, then, you know, we've lost some opportunities because we've got them here at least 40 hours a week. So if we're just creating an environment that they want to stay in, even if they get a little bit of an increase in pay, then we've kind of missed an opportunity. And so I think those are two of the biggest challenges, the access and then maintaining a stable, you know, work team, work, you know, environment for the team members that are here.
Yeah, I would greatly agree with that too. And today's workforce is really different, aren't they? I mean, talk a little bit about generational leadership. You know, how do you manage, you know, old gray haired people like me versus people coming out of school? You know, we have very different work ethics and expectations about work. So how do you balance that?
Right. Well, I think one approach that has served me well, I started my career in process improvement. And so I was facilitating multidisciplinary teams. So I was never the one that was the expert in the room. I was always having to leverage the different subject matter experts who may or may not have interacted on a daily or regular basis, but somebody knew about imaging, somebody knew about the ED, somebody knew about transferring a patient from ED into the, you know, inpatient suite. So I was always kind of trying to facilitate a discussion and pulling the pertinent pieces out. And I think coming from that background has served me better than if I had come from a different background with managing the different age groups here, because, you know, with me being in my 50s, I am part of one of the age groups. And then looking at, you know, and living with children that are now 24 and 21, I've seen what they came up with, you know, when they got their first iPhones. And, you know, we were just talking with our younger son who's in college about managing social media and not allowing it to consume more time than you want it to. And so I think being able to focus on the individual has allowed me as a leader to adapt to those different age groups. I tend to not like to take a blanket approach because I always have the comment in the back of my mind from a former leader of mine that says, you know, one size doesn't fit all. It basically doesn't fit anybody, you know, if it's just one approach. So, and, you know, and coming from a background where I facilitated group interaction, you know, when we get together like tomorrow morning for our staff meeting, I can only present myself and my information the way that I think is going to be the most effective. But then once I see the reaction and I can hear some of the questions, then I can start to tailor my responses, you know, to, you know, the more senior staff or the younger staff that want to know more what's in it for them. You know, what does it mean? You know, one of the things I've noticed is the younger, earlier career folks are really much more interested in safety and security than I remember being early in my career. And I think about why that is. And, you know, with the media and some of the things that we've seen in history, you know, it's become a pertinent consideration for younger people. And I say younger, I mean, they may even be in their 30s or 40s.
Yeah, well, they're younger than me. But, you know, that's a really interesting point, Patrick, that I hadn't thought of, but you're dead on. You know, in thinking about my interactions with employees of that age, they are much more attuned to the safety and security than we were. And I think that, you know, it's just, it's the, as you said, the media that they've been exposed to, the environment that they've grown up in, it's not like it was when we were kids. You know, I mean, they didn't have the luxury of going out and riding their bike all around town and knowing that you're going to be safe. They didn't have the luxury of playing in their front yard and knowing that nothing's going to happen to them.
I mean, I think about when I was younger, you know, my dad would get home from work and read the newspaper. And that, you know, that in television was where you got all your news. Well, when I was younger, I wasn't interested in a newspaper, you know, but I look at our sons and, you know, they weren't interested in news when they got their iPhones either, but they got exposed to it. And I think, you know, that's a little bit of a different upbringing than I had personally.
Yeah. Me too. Me too. That's interesting. So, hey, in the last couple of minutes, you know, again, we were talking before we started recording about just the prevalence of AI now. I just got back from an AI and healthcare conference. Talk to me a little bit about how, and UT Southwestern has always been an innovation leader in everything healthcare. Talk to me a little bit about how, you know, just your practice is utilizing AI.
So interestingly enough, not too long ago, we did get the announcement that UT Southwestern, you know, being on the forefront of a lot of aspects of healthcare, had named a chief AI officer. Now, that's a real person, not an AI officer per se, but I thought, like, you know, and it struck me as curious, and my wife is in education and big with working with women entrepreneurs through Texas Women's University. And I mentioned it to her and she thought, man, that's a great idea because this is a new frontier. And you think about the amount of research we do at a university level and, you know, trying to make sure that access to information is only granted on appropriate levels. It does make a lot of sense. And so part of the way we're leveraging it within the clinic is, you know, helping support our providers to be more efficient or as efficient as they can be using AI in their, you know, note-taking. I've had it in other practices that I've gone to where, you know, they ask me if I mind if they record it and that it'll be, you know, transcribed and that they will edit it. And I think it's a, you know, it's just like years ago when the internet came and we weren't sure what to do with it. We thought it was going to do some things it didn't do. We didn't know it was going to do things that it did do. And I think with AI now, we're in a similar situation, you know, because you can hear some concerns from some areas about, you know, needing to manage it, which seems appropriate. But then there are others who are, you know, more locked on the efficiencies to be gained. And, you know, there are tremendous efficiencies. So I know at the clinical and the operational level, the biggest thing now is how do we leverage it to support patient care? You know, and you probably remember it from your experiences. there are challenges with provider work-life balance when it comes to closing charts, you know, putting as much information into the medical record as is needed to justify treatment options. And so to be able to smooth that a little bit, have it be 100% accurate, but also much more efficient for the provider is really where our focus is.
Well, very good. Again, just in my last 8-9 months of my advisory work, I found the utilization of AI in so many different forms and fashions across healthcare. But there is still that real concern and trepidation among a lot of healthcare workers who know AI is coming. So there's still lots of education going on out there. So it's good to hear that UT Southwestern has designated a real person as the AI leader, because regardless of what AI can do, we still need the human element that has the empathetic and emotional connection, because, you know, our industry is certainly that. Empathetic and emotional. So, yep. Well, hey, Patrick, I've really enjoyed having you on. Any final words you'd like to share with my audience?
No, I appreciate the time. You know, being a head and neck cancer survivor, I try to get the message out to, you know, to parents of young children to, you know, consult with their pediatrician on vaccinations, including the HPV vaccine, which is truly one of the few that can prevent adult cancer. So just want to get that plug in there. Thank you for the time, Kevin.
Well, I appreciate it. Patrick Makarowicz from UT Southwestern, thanks for joining me on I Don't Care with me, Dr. Kevin Stevenson. And thank you out there in the interweb world for joining me. And I look forward to seeing you again next week. Take care.